From Studio H3 and the Current Affairs World Headquarters, it's Current Affairs, your ear's greatest hour of politics and culture. Today on the program, we dissect why right-wingers call everything biased, question the purpose of landlords, and share our lesser-known historical heroes. Our panel today, Current Affairs Senior Editor Brianna Renix.
Hey.
Current Affairs Social Media Editor Vanessa A. B.
Hi.
Current Affairs Finance Editor Sparky Abraham.
Hello.
And the Editor-in-Chief himself, Nathan J. Robinson.
Hello.
I'm your host, Pete Davis. We begin with segment one. Let's unpack a right-wing platitude. In this recurring segment, Let's Unpack a Right-Wing Platitude, we crack open a common right-wing talking point to see what's inside. What's the grain of truth? What's total malarkey? And what do we have to say in response? In this week's Let's Unpack a Right-Wing Platitude, we examine the incessant accusation that prominent institutions like the media, academia, science, and tech have a left-wing bias, that they are failing to remain neutral. PBS, The New York Times, The Washington Post, CNN, dozens of colleges, Google image search results, Facebook, science journals, and hundreds of other institutions are accused of bias all the time. And disturbingly, many often are responding to their accusations by moving right. Panel, what do we have to say about this? Is there anything true in there, or is it total hogwash? Let's unpack this right-wing platitude.
I mean, obviously, every institution is biased and every person is biased. So I think they're probably right a lot of the time in saying things are biased insofar as it's impossible to escape your particular subjective frame. To me, the problem is that bias is never unless bias means distorting your presentation of facts and being unfair to other people. Bias isn't necessarily a problem. Unfairness is a problem. It's not a problem to have to come from a particular set of strongly held moral convictions. You probably should have bias in that sense. So if that's what we mean, then I think it's inescapable and probably a good thing.
What do you mean? Bias is fine, but unfairness is not. What is unfairness?
So the way we've thought about it, Current Affairs, right, is are we a biased institution? Well, we come from a left-wing perspective. Actually, so bias is bad if bias means that we are presenting the truth in a way that is very misleading, that we are picking the facts that only serve our side. That kind of bias would be bad, but I don't think it's a bad thing, and I embrace the fact that we come from a particular perspective. So I don't think that's a legitimate criticism to say that somebody has a particularly strongly held set of values.
I think I would disagree with that. I mean, I think that generally, maybe one way to think about it is that people can be split into three classes: referees, participants, and observers. So I think we would expect, rightfully so, the referee class to have no dog in the fight and to sort of be like sort of merely administering the fight and setting and implementing the rules that guide how we're going to fight about this. Whereas with the participants, I think it's completely fine for the participants to fight for themselves or the side that would result in some sort of advantage for themselves. And then I think with observers, you know, it can sort of go either way. Like, you might not care enough to have a dog in the fight. You might not be informed enough to have a dog in the fight. And maybe observers are more likely to be swayed either way. You know, although their personal experience and sort of like political leanings might make like particular arguments more attractive to them than others. But I think the value of, like, I think neutrality or bias only takes on a value based on which class is reflecting it. So I think it's okay for us to be upset when we expect some parties to be referees and we're seeing bias from them. And it's completely ridiculous to be upset when the participants, so say a magazine, shows like no neutrality in how, you know, we're providing opinions or weighing in on certain issues.
Vanessa, what do you think about the New York Times op-ed page? Do you think they referees, or you think they should embrace the role of referees? And do you think it's possible to actually be a referee without any dog in any fight?
I think the op-ed page is is explicitly, almost explicitly for participants. And so in that case, I think it's fine for them to reflect views that I may not agree with. And the op-ed page is run by, you know, it sort of runs in parallel and separately from the news portion of the New York Times. And in which case, you know, it is upsetting when we see like the news side of the New York Times, which should be reporting facts with context and as much detail as possible. And when we're seeing some of the details be obscured and it looks like that obscuring is the result of a bias, then I think it's fair for us to question if the New York Times is actually doing its job.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of an open question whether a publication like the New York Times should be aspiring to be sort of like a town hall sort of setting where you have a presentation of a wide variety of views. And in that case, the criteria would simply be, are they actually presenting the full range of views that exists? So is the problem like that they are picking too many right-wing people and not actually picking anybody who's a progressive to be on the op-ed page? But then maybe we actually think that that this is all just kind of a kind of for show, and that maybe it'd be better if publications just admitted what their bias was and only promoted viewpoints that they actually think are worthwhile. I kind of go back and forth on this because I think that I'm cynical about the ability of a newspaper to actually be a neutral referee. And so I would, in some ways, rather they just kind of come out and say what they actually think and promote the views only that they agree with. But in an ideal world, maybe it would be possible to have these sort of forums where you could actually have a balanced presentation of a wide variety of views.
It's an interesting question. How does this like bias work? So one type of bias that's been talked about is like the bias of all the facts of one side of an argument. There's an immigration article and it has only facts supporting one policy and not facts supporting another policy. That's a type of bias. The other one is the decision to have any article or op-ed writer in the first place. So one example I've heard from conservatives is that the PBS show Frontline, which is like impeccably journalistic. They have people from every side on every issue. It is not biased in facts, but it's biased because, according to these conservatives, that they've had front lines on this, that, and the other, but they've never had a front line on the burdens of taxation, or they've never had a front line on the decline in marriage rates or something. And from my lefty perspective, there hasn't been a front line on like labor unions in decline, but there has been on, you know, the Trump-Russia conspiracy. And so there's like the bias of choice. And how can you... what criteria can we say that like all of the issues are being discussed when like both Noam Chomsky is saying the New York Times is biased and Glenn Beck is saying the New York Times is biased?
I'm on the one hand, I kind of like the approach that British newspapers take, where you know where they stand, right? There's no attempt to disguise their bias. You have right wing papers, left wing papers, center left papers. And that feels a little more honest. I know what I'm going to get, and they're very upfront. On the other hand, it's terrible because it means that they do end up having to disguise or bury facts or not report stories that don't go on with their stated institutional mission. And I think that's always bad, right? So this is why I try and achieve this compromise where you're like, you have the political views that you have, but the thing you do is not try and pretend that you don't, but try and be extremely fair to the other side. Like, I think the newspapers should be open about what the people who write them believe, instead of like, you know, Times tries to like not let its reporters have political opinions on Twitter. And I think that's just like dishonest. Don't pretend otherwise. But also, If we write something in Current Affairs that's critiquing a right-wing argument, we have to present it fairly. We have to confront the facts that would seem to undercut our position and explain why we think they don't. And I think anything that tries to sweep the alternate perspective under the rug or not engage with it is bad. And that's probably, instead of trying to eliminate perspective, you should be trying to eliminate, as I mentioned before, unfairness.
So like opinion, but not propaganda.
Yeah, not polemic. Argument rather than polemic.
Yeah, I think one of the problems that you run into when you have publications that are specifically politically aligned but don't attempt to do this sort of engaging with other narratives and presenting them and using counter evidence is that you then have these very polarized news narratives that actually are not in dialogue with each other at all, so that people from different political parties are not even concerned about the same things. And I think you kind of see a lot of that with when Trump gets up sometimes and says something really wacky, like, you know, like all the problems they're having in Sweden, or like people in London are being like stabbed en masse. And everyone on the left is like, what the fuck is that? Like, they have no idea where this is coming from. But if you're reading right-wing publications, this is the stuff that they are talking about all the time. And
it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, so
them, yeah.
You get to this problem where people who are not engaged with these publications are like, what is this? What alternate reality is this? And that's kind of a problem, probably.
Well, and for them, when we start saying, like, the first day that Bernie says late capitalism or Kirsten Gillibrand says rape culture or something, they'll be like, what is she talking about? And we know exactly what they're talking about because we live in our thing, but we don't want to lapse into like, oh, they have their world, it's fine, and we have our world, and it's fine, and which it seems like what you're trying to break through.
I guess, like, I understand what you're saying in terms of that problem, but I'm not quite sure, like, which direction the problem goes. Is that a problem with media that is honest about its viewpoint, or is that a problem with media that's concealing its viewpoint, or is that maybe a problem with both, and just like, now that the internet has kind of blown up the market for media consumption, suddenly people are much more able to live in their own whatever. I guess my question is there a way to structure things so that different viewpoints will actually meaningfully engage with each other, especially given a universe where you have almost unlimited options for where to engage?
Well, you know, personally, I've been disturbed by the fact that so many prominent right-wing publications, the Prager University YouTube videos I read about recently, where those have millions and millions of views, and they're well-produced, and they explain a right-wing talking point with animations and a sort of prominent conservative commentator, and there's no response from the left, right? They just ignore them. They just pretend they don't exist. So at the very least, like, the bare minimum criterion, I think, would be that you can't ignore something that millions of people are paying attention to. And I did a long review of Dinesh D'Souza's book, which no liberal publication or mainstream publication did, even though it was in a top 10 bestseller, right? It's a top 10 bestseller accusing the left of being actual Nazis. And you think, well, that's ludicrous, but also there are millions and millions of people. You can't just pretend they're not alive or they you live in the same country as them.
I sometimes think about the metaphor of like a courtroom where, like, Dinesh D'Souza plays a prosecutor. He's prosecuting the left. Jonah Goldberg, like, with liberal fascism, is doing that too. It's like they're just every day mustering every single argument they can against this. And this is a critique people have of Glenn Greenwald too. But I'm just like, if you start thinking of Glenn Greenwald as a prosecutor of imperialism, it's like, it's his job to just prosecute. It's not his job to be the judge. And I wonder, a world where you're saying we need to have a defense attorney for the left.
Well, I want a world without prosecutors. Don't get me wrong. I can't stand prosecutors.
Okay, no, but Glenn Greenwald has, to many, has provided a wonderful service by just not hosting a, like, some say the war in Iraq is bad, while others say it's good, you know? Which seemed to have not broken through to the American people, but when someone says, it's all bad, it's very bad, bad, yeah. Bad, 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 you know, that breaks through, and he suddenly... You know, that's that I think played at least a non-zero role in the kind of blowback.
Though I don't think those are the only two options.
Okay, what are the other options?
Well, it's not like, you know, either we bring the guy who thinks the world is flat and the guy who thinks the world is round and let they hash it out, or we take an approach that's like, no, we're going to grind the other side into dust. I think you could be fair and not compromise your position and not say that there's no truth and who knows and let's just let everyone have their say.
Do you eventually have to stop being fair, though? Like, how many times are you going to talk about whether the world is flat or not?
Until it's not a popular position, until it's totally a fringe position. So climate change, for example, you can stop having the debate once you've solved the problem. That's when you can stop.
Is the world being flat fringe enough?
And by giving the crazy argument some air, you're I mean, I think there's an argument that you're also giving it some legitimacy. So you're not actually allowing like the debate to settle and end, because we're still pretending that the flat earth is like a position valid enough that we're actually going to debate it. And it's like maybe one way to make sure that we have fewer people, you know, believing in these crazy theories is by not even including them in the textbooks as like some other people believe this is the way the earth looks, you know, but we all know the earth is round. So let's just not even give them, you know, that space.
But if that's people's parents, like if kids go to school and like their parents are telling them the opposite of the book, I think it'd be helpful if the book explained like why that's not true.
Right. I mean, I guess I take your point. It's short of just waiting for that generation to die off, I guess.
That's that's a solution to everything.
A fine solution.
Well, but I mean, so the flat earth thing maybe is not a great example, because that is actually in real life an extremely fringe position.
Right.
But if you took something like people who don't believe that evolution is a viable theory, like that's more than 50% of the U.S. population, I think, the last time they pulled it. So if you're going to...
The opposite of a fringe theory.
Yeah, so if you were going to write an article or do a textbook on evolution, it would make sense to bring in those arguments and try to refute them, because otherwise people are just going to say, well, they're not engaging with it because they don't have any counterpoints to this. They think young earth creationism is too strong to stand up against facts, which that seems like a capitulation.
Yeah, in some ways we need to be in the arenas. We need to enter their echo chambers and like give an alternate argument. Brianna, you mentioned something a few weeks ago about how Breitbart actually provides some of the few on the ground reporting at the border, and so you've had to rely on that sometimes to just get like basic facts about things, because they're the only ones covering that issue because they care about it for racist
reasons.
Yeah,
like I've legitimately in asylum cases documentation have included Breitbart articles, because they're the people who are like, there's a gun battle happening in this town and the police didn't intervene and no one knows what's going on. And sometimes if that's the town your person came from, I need that information. And the New York Times is not going down there to like collect that information. So it's going to have to be Breitbart, which is a terrible position to be in. And Nathan and I actually wrote an article about how bad this is in the context of Mexico, that like, why are we allowing Breitbart to dictate the narrative on the border and on the Mexican drug cartels and the drug war? Because they clearly have a very specific narrative they want to promote, and we're not really combating it because we're not actually investigating any of these situations ourselves.
I've seen similar things with like a territory that usually conservatives are on, which is like the question of like civic life and the family and religion and the like major changes happening in American culture around that. I have lefty views on it, but I care about it as a topic. You know, if divorce rates are changing, that's an interesting thing that's we should think about. But again, you're only going to get a bunch of like Ross Douthats like following those studies. And so we don't have any left wing voices on those questions. So I think there's a lot of territory that we could...
This is, by the way, why I end up writing really long articles about Jordan Peterson and Charles Murray that are extremely tedious, because like the perspective on the left for 20 years since the bell curve has been come out has been we just ignore him. But he doesn't go away. He just won't stop being present. And I think it's just so important to reiterate over and over why he's wrong, because central to their arguments is the left won't engage with us because they fear the truth. They fear what we have to say, and they have to shut us down because they can't engage with what we have to say. And unfortunately, that puts you in the position where the thing that you feel like you need to do, which is just ignore it because it's so awful as to that it creates legitimacy even by having the discussion, is the thing that helps confirm them. It's a very clever trick that they do. I mean, it's how Milo Yiannopoulos built his whole career.
You won't debate me, but then like they don't really want to debate. We're running out of time for this segment, but I want to go around one more time to let everyone share their final thoughts on the topic of bias and neutrality. Let's start with Brianna.
I guess my final thought, since we started by listing some of the institutions that are accused of left-wing bias, is that I always find it hilarious that academia is considered a institution with left-wing bias, because academia is incredibly conservative, both in its like labor practices towards its workers and like the direction that it pushes students in. So I always find that very funny.
Sparky?
Yeah, I mean, I think building off that, like one of the things that seems challenging to do when you talk about this stuff is to figure out exactly what people mean when they talk about bias, and like to try to narrow, okay, what institutions are we talking about and what are the roles? And actually that's extremely complex, and it might be different for like different types of academia or different types of media or like different types of magazines. And so, I mean, I just have trouble thinking about it, and it makes me think that maybe taking like a much more specific approach and like trying to take the argument about bias seriously in the most specific examples possible might be the best way to approach it.
Vanessa?
On the one hand, you know, I like personally really enjoy the little echo chamber that I've built for myself in my personal life.
And the joy of the echo chamber.
That's right. At the same time, like, I think we really can hone our ideas and our views when we really engage with the other side and consider arguments that are made to push back against like the ideas that we think would make the world a better place. But then I struggle to reconcile that with the fact that like, okay, the world is so big now. So is there a way, like, can the New York Times get its readers to engage with the other side without like literally hiring Barry Weiss? And so I just don't know like what the balance is. And I just have to sort of continue, at least in my own writing, I think I have to make it a habit to continue, you know, considering arguments for the other side and incorporating that.
Nathan?
Yeah, I'm really afraid of going down the route like the PBS having, oh, we need a conservative show. And what I'm trying to do is figure out a way to avoid the problem of retreating into a bubble that represents a diminishing minority of the country and doesn't end up building greater and greater support without providing legitimacy. And there's a book called Why Evolution is True by Jerry Coyne, who's an evolutionary biologist. And it's just laying out the case for why evolution is true, and all throughout it he's like seems very resentful of having to do so, but he doesn't grant any legitimacy, and I love the way he does it, because he doesn't grant any legitimacy to the other side, but he recognizes that it's a necessary task. And I think that is the better approach to than the we need to hire a bunch of conservative columnists approach, which I don't think helps at all, and I think also probably is immoral, because I think right-wing views are fundamentally immoral.
And I'll give my two cents to that. I think I'm going to plus one Sparky's idea, you know, how virtue ethics is to like these universal ethics as a way of saying like we need to cut it down to size. Maybe there's like virtue neutrality of certain institutions have certain mandates of what they're going to open themselves up to or not. So like science has a different one than PBS, has a different one than New York Times. We have to go to break, but we'll be back with segment two on Big Landlords shortly. This episode is sponsored by the Current Affairs Radio Archive. Anyone who stops by the listening room at the Current Affairs World Headquarters can browse clips from throughout the program's 85-year run. In this clip from 1936, we hear a scene from season 3 of Red Rose, the flagship production of the short-lived Current Affairs Radio Theater.
Presenting the rip-roaring radical exploits of Red Rose, the globe-trotting socialist adventuress. Last week, as the dashing Red Rose and her plucky sidekick, Lucy, attempted to foil a sinister plot by the BUF, the British Union of Fascists, that is, they were captured by the nefarious Blackshirts and imprisoned in the castle of the Blackshirts' leader, Sir Oswald Mosley.
Oh, Red Rose, the corkers for sure!
Come on, Lucy. We face down worse than Mosley and his chromatically challenged crew.
Agitate with anxiety as our heroines are dragged before the evil Sir Oswald Mosley himself.
Red Rose, however did you discover our clever little plan to bring bombs to the march on Cable Street? Well, never mind. The two of you shall remain by my side and bear witness as our Nazi allies deliver the bombs that will be the undoing of these anti-fascists once and for all.
Begging your pardon, Sir Mosley. but our German contacts sent new orders. They want to meet us at the landing site.
Yes, that is. I suppose we shall do as they say.
Gee, talk about triumph of the will.
As our heroines are delivered to the landing site of the Nazi Zeppelin, the valiant Lucy suddenly remembers.
Hey, Red Rose, I just remembered. I still got one of them fireworks in my purse.
Great, Lucy. Here's the plan.
Oh, Mr. Mosley.
That's Sir Mosley.
Sir Mosley, before I die, could I just have one last light for my cigarette?
Well, I don't suppose why not. I am a gentleman after all.
Lucy, let's make tracks. We gotta steal that Zeppelin.
Tune in next week for more of the rip-roaring radical exploits of Red Rose, the globe-trotting socialist adventuress.
Hear more at the Current Affairs Radio Archive. We're back with segment two, Useful Topic with a Useless News Peg. In the recurring segment, Useful Topic with a Useless News Peg, we talk about something very important that is in the news because of something very unimportant. Something unimportant in the news this month, having to think about Fox News host Sean Hannity because he's in another scandal. This time for allegedly receiving millions of dollars in Housing and Urban Development Department subsidies to purchase and profit from foreclosed homes. Inside of this unimportant story, however, is something very important. The continuing ripples of the foreclosure crisis, the trend of distant financiers becoming your landlord, and the question of big landlords in general. Vanessa, fill us in on this story and get us started on the question of what the panel should think about the morality and politics of real estate and absentee landlordism.
It came out recently, as you mentioned, that Sean Hannity had purchased, I think, around $93 million worth of property. Some of them were multi-million dollar homes for his personal use. But he also had used these shell companies to purchase homes that were now on the rental housing market. And I think he purchased the majority of that housing in Georgia, in counties that had struggled economically after the financial crisis. So it just so happens that Georgia has tenant rights that are sort of less expensive than in some other jurisdictions. And so that raises, I think, interesting questions about what we think about, you know, people and companies being able to buy things from afar. What Sean Hannity did, I think, is part of a larger trend where after the financial crisis, private equity firms saw that because people were losing homes that they had purchased, that naturally there would be a boom in the demand for rental housing. And so what a lot of these private equity firms ended up doing is purchasing these property en masse and becoming landlords from afar, collecting people's rents, and then actually mimicking what they had been doing in the homeowner market before the crisis, which is to take these rents, pool them, and then sell them in little, sort of guarantee the profits that would come from these rents to investors.
So instead of bundled mortgages, it's bundled rents.
Right. And so the reason why people invest in these financial instruments in the first place is that they want to make more money than if their money just sat around in their savings account. So they're trying to beat the rate of inflation. But if you're doing that with rents, it means that, one, you're committing to aggressively raise rents, right? Because you want this to keep being a good deal for your investors. And you also have to be somewhat committed to being able to get people out quickly. And like sort of naturally, it, from like a legal perspective, it is easier to evict people, to evict tenants in most jurisdictions than it is to foreclose on tenants. And so I think it really should be alarming to anyone who cares about these things to see these sort of nameless landlords snap up, you know, hundreds of properties at a time in various markets.
So I actually heard something relatively interesting at a conference recently from an executive at a large national bank. which was, I mean, he was basically worried about this same thing, right? These kind of large institutional landlords. He was obviously not necessarily worried about it from like what's happening to renters, but more he characterized this as something that the bank had always wanted to do, but had never been able to do in terms of managing thousands of properties nationwide and collecting rents. And it just made me kind of remember that, you know, oh, of course, I'd been thinking of this bank as, you know, a bank that's interested in mortgages. The bank's not interested in mortgages. The bank's interested in monetizing the housing market, right? And like Blackstone found a more efficient way to do that, and he was upset about that.
Is what changed that it's just logistically easier to be a landlord from afar now because of tech, or is it some financials or legal situation?
I would guess that it's probably a combination, right? It's easier because of tech, but also there was the crash, which created like Vanessa was saying, like this combination of a bunch of cheap available properties that you could buy en masse, and also a restriction of credit for everybody who might have got them with a mortgage.
This is such a classic example of one of the great lies of modern capitalism being like the capitalism of textbooks, because it's one group has a bunch of money, the other group doesn't have enough money to invest in their own community to or for their own individual thing, and then they come in, swoop up, and then they're in charge. And actually, Sean Hannity in his statement in response said, it's ironic that I'm being attacked for investing my personal money in a community that badly needs such investment, and in which I'm sure those attacking me have not invested their money. And he's acting like, oh, he's doing philanthropy by investing in you know, a poor community by owning the community, but and taking the profits of the community. But I'm sure all the people in that community would have loved to have invested their own money in their own house. But this is what happens when there's such inequality.
And I think what we're seeing happen in some cases is that it actually becomes even more profitable for these landlords to go into markets that are relatively affordable. Like, imagine having a small community with only so many properties available for purchase. BlackRock comes in, purchases, you know, 150 units out of 200. Maybe the first year you think it's not so bad, like they're sort of maintaining the rents where they were. But then the following year, they raise the rent average by 4%, following year by 5%. What that signals to smaller landlord is that all of a sudden, they can also make a larger profit by raising the rents. Like, all they have to do to stay competitive is to have their rents just be slightly lower than what this large investor is doing in the community, right? And if you're buying in such large numbers, but the community isn't building more units at the same rate, then eventually tenants aren't going to have like many avenues. Like, they're going to have to take it because they won't have a choice and they're already shut out of the homeowning market. And then add to that the layer that your landlord is actually a shell company hiding behind another shell company. So both the tenants and the organizers, you know, in your community, like, don't know who to escalate a complaint to, don't know who to sue to, like, enforce whatever, you know, small rights they may have. It's like, I really don't view it as like a philanthropic enterprise, and I think it's really misleading for Sean Hannity to, you know, frame it that way.
It strikes me though, Vanessa, that this is that also suggests it's not just a problem of landlords that are large, far away property holders and shell companies, but that this is, we should get to sort of the fundamental question of the owners and renters generally, and whether this is just a problem of a world with landlords in it. You know, the worst landlords I've ever had have been the smallest landlords, have been like the person, where they were just a terrible person. And the companies were actually pretty good. And it strikes me that the balance of power and ownership between renters and property holders would not necessarily be that much better if Sean Hannity wasn't in the property market.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, each, you know, like, the difference between having a big landlord and a small landlord to a tenant is probably none if either is shitty, right? Like, I don't don't know. I guess like a positive of having a smaller landlord is that you can like communicate your grievances easier, but they also tend to have like their pockets are usually not as deep as a larger company. And yeah, like the larger companies that aren't private equity firms, but are actually like management companies, I think, that are just better versed in navigating landlord tenant laws are probably better landlords overall. And they're also easier to organize against because they respond to pressures.
This seems to be very similar to one of the debates on like the People's Policy Project's Matt Brunig has been having a debate with Matt Stoller of the Open Markets Initiative on are big businesses or are big employers or small employers good for you? And it mirrors a lot of this. So, for example, big employers are bad because they're distant. You can't knock on their door. You don't go to church with them. They're not in your community, but they're good in that they have like, you know, sexual harassment policies that respond to pressure. They have a lot of money that you can sue. They try to at least keep things like stable and like have a system for, even if the system is bad. Whereas like a tiny restaurant might just like, you know, that's where most of the wage theft is coming from. And so landlords have this problem. I'm seeing a lot of parallels there too. But one interesting thing about that I've always been interested in about landlords is this seems to be like the least in the story that like market fundamentalists tell about capitalism. Landlords seem to be the least affectionate, like they seem to be the least sympathetic figure, because, you know, like if the king of that story is like Steve Jobs, like someone who thought up an idea and, you know, came up with it and built a giant business around it, a landlord is someone who got hold of a piece of land that we all philosophically should have like have each equal act like equal legitimacy to, and now is getting rents off of it without providing much added benefit except for the, you know, the mechanisms of giving us the rents of it. And I guess maybe that's the question you were getting to, Nathan, of, you know, are landlords in our visions of the future for the left, what role do landlords play, or do they not anymore?
Their wealth exists solely because you don't have wealth. And also, as you point out, the original it's difficult to construct a philosophical justification for the original acquisition of land. For, you know, if we take it back generations to generation, first, because as a matter of fact, in this country, it's all stolen. But also anywhere, you know, why does someone get to?
I guess I was just going to ask whether lenders and like mortgage lenders specifically get out of that. I mean, are they not also just kind of getting free ride on the unequal distribution of land and wealth? Like, if I had the cash to buy the property that I'm buying, then I would buy it and they wouldn't make a bunch of interest off me.
Well, this raises a really interesting question of, you know, Bush, at least rhetorically, was for this idea of the ownership society. And his future of housing was we should have less renters and we should have more owners. There's a left-wing view of this, which is like community land trusts, which is we will be renters or even owners, but the landlord will be someone who has our interests at heart through some mechanism. Is this solved by ownership, I guess, is the question you're raising.
Yeah, I mean, I think about that. Is this solved by, I guess, like resident ownership? And is it solved by resident ownership the way that resident ownership generally works right now, which is most people have mortgages? Or do we need a different kind of resident ownership to solve the problem?
Brianna Reddix, what do you think about landlords?
I don't care for them.
I'm shocked.
It was fascinating because one of my first days at law school, we were working with our seat buddy on like an issue spotter, and it involved a tenant being evicted, and you were supposed to try and like think about like whether, you know, they should be evicted or shouldn't be evicted. Of course, I'm thinking like, well, we have to find a way to stop them from being evicted. I shortly realized that the person I'm talking to is a landlord. This like 25-year-old kid is like, well, you know, you can't do that. And it was just bizarre to me that this world where like children practically like can own property and exact rent from people and then kick them out of their property. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah. Something that Thomas Piketty brings up in his book, right, in Capital in the 21st Century. And he traces this whole history of inequality throughout time. And like a recurring theme is like this entire rentier class. Like, all they do is sit around and let their money make money for their money. And like let their assets also make money. And it's like deeply unfair. You know, like at what stage do we say, okay, you've passed this bullshit down enough generations. Like, we're taking it back now.
Sorry. Yeah. Because it's like one of those things where, like, the job that they do is, like, every 6 months they might have to fix a faucet. Like, that's not a job. Like, why should you get paid for that?
My prime example of this is Jared Kushner, who, when he was an undergrad, spent his undergrad years buying up half of Somerville. Like, he
in Somerville. He was just, like, again, a child. Like, in Harvard, just being, like, dabbling in the housing market in the town next
door. And all of that is inherited wealth, the least legitimate kind of wealth.
Why don't more politicians take this up? Because this does not, I'm sorry to harp on this again, but this has no entrepreneurial sheen. Like, all of the love for entrepreneurs in America by kind of middle of the road folks, it doesn't apply to landlords, and everyone hates, everyone, they don't hate, but like their landlord is not a happy thing in their life. And I don't know why someone's not taking this up. I guess the rent is too damn high party was the closest we got to that.
I think what ends up happening in a lot of places is that, like, there is a powerful class of developers who lobby very hard for certain rules that will benefit them, and then small-time landlords end up benefiting from those. So, like, no one is actually rooting for landlords to win, but they sort of get to reap the fruit of the developers' labor. And municipalities love developers.
Okay, we're going to have to go to break, but we'll be back with our final segment with some hopeful precedents. A reminder to everyone that Current Affairs is a two-way street. Our voicemail lines are open at 504-867-8851. That's 504-867-8851. If you call in, we might play your voicemail on the program, just like we're about to do with Sean Haskett's recent voicemail.
Hello. Hi, my name is Sean Haskett, and I just wanted to let you guys know that I found the skits from this first podcast hysterical. I was cackling in my car quite deeply, I would say. Yeah, I just appreciate that you guys have a commitment to, like, making the left a fun place to be, even as, you know, you stick to the whole, like, everything is fundamentally broken and we need to fix the whole world thing. Yeah, bye.
Thank you for that, Sean. We really appreciate it. It means a lot that you called. And we're going to do our best to remain committed to joy and the whole everything is fundamentally broken and we gotta fix it thing too. If you're voicemail shy, though, you can also write us letters to the editor at editor@currentaffairs.org. Here's a recent letter we received, read by Vanessa.
This letter is coming to us from Neil deGrasse Tyson, president of the National Association of Very Pragmatic and Very Serious Scientists. Dear Current Affairs, I'm told your magazine refuses to publish poetry. In case you were wondering, this was a smart decision. Poetry is ridiculous. Consider the following example. But soft, wet light through yonder window breaks. It is the east. And Juliet is the sun. Now this is patently absurd. The sun is a G-type main sequence star composed primarily of hydrogen and helium gas. A 14-year-old girl, therefore, cannot be the sun. She doesn't even generate her own fusion reactions. The bard, quote unquote, may have been a contemporary of Galileo's, but clearly he did not know anything about science. Sincerely, Neil deGrasse Tyson.
We're back for our final segment, segment three, Hopeful Precedents. A picture is worth 1,000 words, and a precedent is worth 1,000 opinions. In this recurring segment, Hopeful Precedents, we point to splendid exemplars of our political dreams. Precedents in history, precedents around the world, precedents happening right next door, but that no one has heard of yet. This week on Hopeful Precedents, we turn to history and share each of our favorite underappreciated historical heroes so we can end in a good mood. Who would like to go first with their favorite historical hero? I actually love, before the show, we were going over who each one was going to say, and Brianna and I selected the same person, and I have to think up another one. But
we're the only two people on the planet who probably would have picked this person. I mean, I don't know. Maybe not. Yeah, so this was kind of a tough question because I was racking my brains, and the problem is that there's not really typically a one-to-one correlation between people who become famous in history and people who, like, you know, work hard with no expectation of reward and are nice to their families. So it was hard to think of a historical person that I wanted to talk about. But then I remembered the existence of this person who's amazing. His name is Benjamin Lay.
Benjamin Lay.
Yes. So he's born 1682, dies 1759. He was 4 feet tall. He was a Quaker. He had like a hunched back and very long arms. So create that mental picture in your mind. He was an abolitionist in sort of before it was cool. Like there was no abolitionist party. There was no large scale abolitionist movement. He was a very serious abolitionist. He was so serious about being against slavery that he refused to buy any clothes. He would make all his own clothes to ensure that nothing that he wore was like associated with slave labor. He also was a vegetarian who like grew his own nuts and berries because he didn't want to have to kill any animals. He was like this incessant pamphleteer who would write all these pamphlets against slavery, against capital punishment, against prisons, things like that. And he was viewed as this kind of just like crazy person who would just show up at like Quaker meetings all the time and just like yell about slavery. And people would be like, it's
Benjamin, join DSA.
So I want to tell you about three stunts that he pulled that are especially amazing. So one, he used to stand outside in the snow with no coat and no shoes. And when people would stop and ask him whether he was okay, he would be like, slaves work under worse conditions than this, and would like get all in their faces about it. Two, he once kidnapped for a couple hours the child of some slaveholders to teach them about how bad family separation was, and then like returned the child. It was like, this is a teachable moment. So thing number two. Thing number three, which is my favorite, is that he once came to a Quaker meeting with a, and he snuck in, he had a sword.
This is amazing.
And he had a Bible that was like a cutaway Bible with like a bag of prune juice hidden inside it. And he stands up at the meeting and he pulls out this, and so he yells, "Thus shall God shed the blood of those persons who enslave their fellow creatures." He pulls out the sword, he stabs the Bible, prune juice goes all over the people in the front pew, a bunch of people faint. It was clearly just this like amazing like metal moment. And what I love about this guy is just that he's like complete like unashamed weirdo. And I think we have this idea in history that morality is relative and that like people thought, you know, things at a certain time and we can't judge them because like how could they have known? But when you look at history, you know, leaving aside the fact that a lot of what people's views that survive are dictated by, you know, who's in power, who has the power to like print or distribute writings and preserve ideas. But if you look hard, there are often people who like did know what was going on and were talking about like moral truths in a way that makes sense to us now. So the idea that like these ideas were not out there is just wrong. And so that, you know, that then empowers you to be more judgmental of people in the past, which is always fun because they're dead, so they can't talk back to you. But yeah, so Benjamin Lay, he's a fun guy.
I love that. I have to just add one thing, which is the name of his most successful yes. pamphlet. I just love this title, and I think we should go back to the structure of titles. All slave keepers that keep the innocent in bondage, comma, apostates.
Oh, so great. Pamphlets were a great time in history. We need to just like write more inflammatory pamphlets. I feel like that would be helpful.
Nathan, you down for an arm of current affairs? That's
we pamphlets. Are most of that already, aren't we? Aren't we just a big angry pamphlet?
We need to work on a title game, though. We don't talk about apostates in our titles.
Next issue.
Sparky, do you have your historical?
Oh my gosh, I have to follow that one.
Sorry. Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
So I actually like, I'm not sure that the person who I picked is quite as ideologically impressive. I don't actually know that much about her ideology, but it's Manuela Sáenz, who was a revolutionary in Ecuador and Peru during the Bolivarian period, and she actually like she was married to some English guy, but she shacked up with Simon Bolivar and marched all over the place with him, thwarted at least one assassination attempt by like getting in the way of the assassins with a sword. I think she also led some troops in battle at one point. She got some military honors, but my favorite part, I think, is like what happened after all of that and after Bolivar died, which is that, I mean, it's actually really sad. She got, she went into exile. She tried to come back, and the leadership of, I guess, Ecuador at that point, wherever she was trying to come back to, said no. She ended up living in like a coastal village. Ecuador denied her, and she ended up living in a coastal village in Peru and just kind of like living in poverty and selling tobacco. And she made her living translating letters between Spanish and English for North American whalers who were passing through on their way to the whaling grounds, which, yeah.
That's dark.
Yeah. And I feel like that's something I would like roll my eyes at, I think, if it was in fiction. Like, come on. But that, and people just came to her house who knew who she was, but it wasn't people in town. Like Herman Melville at one point met with her, and also Garibaldi came and stayed with her at one point. And then she died, and then there were like no mentions of her in any books until I think the 1940s or something. I think she died from a stair collapse in her house, which is also really sad.
Oh my God.
But I mean, I'm not sure if she's like as much precedent. She's definitely a precedent, but she's also just a historical badass.
I feel like we can probably blame a landlord for her death.
Oh, for sure.
Because of the staircase.
The fucking stairs.
Yeah, what was the property ownership structure of that? Like,
yeah. Speaking, you mentioned Garibaldi, so I just want to mention in the line of badass women, there is a statue in Rome, which I feel like it was put up by the fascists, so I feel bad about that. But it's a picture of Garibaldi's wife, who is also kind of one of these like active revolutionary people. And in the statue, she is like on a horse, like brandishing a pistol, and she's also nursing a baby at the same time, which I think that's a great statue. Yes. There should be more statues like that.
Vanessa, your historical hero?
My historical hero is my high school friend. But it actually is. And my story has a happier ending. This person is Lily Jacobson. She was born in 1988, still alive. So when we were in high school, I believe Lily was the first girl to ever play on my high school men's baseball team. And the team was pretty good. Like, they would routinely win state championships in the state of Nevada. And then Lily went on to Vassar College, where she walked on the men's baseball team her sophomore year. Apparently, it was a terrible time. Like, it turns out there are a lot of sexist people out there who hate to see women not throw balls underhand and like just like play baseball with dudes. So that was pretty terrible. But she went on to play with the U.S. women's national baseball team, which is a thing that we have. And I think it's amazing. I don't understand why women have to play softball and men have to play baseball. And I feel like Lily is one of the women out there who is like, no, I want to do the sport that I want to do. And if that means that I'm the only woman on the team, then I will do it that way. And hopefully she's inspired a bunch of other little girls who were also interested in playing baseball. So that's my hero, Lily Jacobson. Just found out this afternoon that she has a Wikipedia page. Ooh. So proud of her. Amazing. This is what I personally aspire to. So,
is current affairs relevant enough to have a Wikipedia page yet?
We do have a Wikipedia. It's a stub.
Oh. So we're still and I think stub level still, notoriety.
There's still a thing at the top that says this page has been flagged for possible irrelevance or whatever it is, like not prominent enough. I didn't make
what?
It. Someone made it, and then Wikipedia has deemed it iffy. So
I don't see the warning here anymore. I'm looking at it right now. It's still a stub, yeah. But I think we passed
the notability threshold finally.
We're breaking.
Are we now a relevant stub instead of an irrelevant stub?
I mean, there's nothing on
That's
here.
That's all I want in
There's
life.
Nothing on here saying we're irrelevant, so I'm taking that as relevance.
That makes me a little sad. I like the idea of just like managing expectations for our readers. You know, we don't know how relevant this magazine or any of these people are. Give it a try, though.
Okay, Nathan, your historical hero.
Yeah, so my guy's been getting a little more prominent recently. I don't know if he counts as forgotten now because he's got a postage stamp named after him. So I picked Benjamin Banneker, who I've written about before in the context of thrashing Charles Murray's ideas to death. Benjamin Banneker lived from 1731 to 1806. And he was a free black man in Maryland who was self-taught. He educated himself and became a surveyor. He was a naturalist, and he was a farmer. He invented a kind of clock, and he did astronomy. He was one of these guys like Franklin, who just dabbled in every single thing which you could do back then. And he also wrote an early American almanac. But the reason I like him is not because he's a pioneering, it's impressive that his parents were slaves and he grew up to make an almanac, but the reason that I love him and that everyone should love him is because of his righteous call out of Thomas Jefferson, because this Banneker recognized the total hypocrisy of the fact that Jefferson wrote stirring tributes to liberty and equality, even as he held quite a lot of slaves, and in fact didn't treat his slaves well, even by the standards of the time. This is another example of how you can't how people at the time, there were people who were pointing these things out. Banneker wrote this wonderful, wonderful letter to Jefferson that I just love, where he makes the case for, first, human equality and the fact that race is a meaningless category, and then calling on Jefferson to be better. And he says, we are a race of beings who have long labored under the abuse and censure of the world, that have been looked on with an eye of contempt and considered rather more brutish than human and scarcely capable of mental endowments. And then he says to Jefferson, I apprehend that you will readily embrace every opportunity to eradicate that train of absurd and false opinions, and that your sentiments are concurrent with mine, which are that one universal Father hath given everything to all and made us all of one flesh. And he says, now, there was, he said, you publicly held forth this true and invaluable doctrine of the equality of human beings, which was very worthy. We hold these truths to be self-evident. But how pitiable it is to reflect that although you were so fully convinced of the benevolence of the Father of mankind and of his equal and impartial distribution of rights, that you should at the same time counteract his mercies in detaining by fraud and violence so numerous a part of my brethren under groaning captivity and cruel oppression. And I just love that. First, because it's just beautifully written. And also because he's just I love it because Jefferson had the ideas of Charles Murray 300 years before, 200 years before, and there was Banneker calling him out, pointing out how false it was, and also demonstrating in the very act of writing the letter how false it was. And Jefferson wrote him this cursory reply saying, thank you for the almanac. And then he wrote to a friend and he was like, the almanac isn't very good. But it again allows us to judge Jefferson, because he had this opportunity to rectify himself, because he was told so eloquently and so forcefully why he was wrong, why it was immoral, and he didn't take that opportunity. Many of his slaves were sold at death. He didn't even free Sally Hemings when he died. So it allows us to really properly contextualize Jefferson and to judge him very harshly.
True story. I had a couple glasses of wine at Christmas and read that letter out loud to my family, and they were very moved. So it's for all time.
It's a great piece of writing.
Yeah. My favorite, the punctum of that story is a cursory response that says, thank you for the almanac.
He also says, I wish the best for your race.
Yeah. Oh my God. What?
Oh my gosh. I really.
Is that like a fill in Microsoft Word salutation or Jesus?
One of the most, overhyped men in American history, Mr. Jefferson. As a Virginian, I'm very bothered by Mr. Jefferson's prominence. We had to learn about him for years on end.
He's the only thing they teach you about in Virginia public schools.
Yes, and he does not deserve that. I'll just quickly end with my favorite historical hero, then we'll close out for today, which is I I actually think underappreciated in American history is Bill W., the guy who created Alcoholics Anonymous, which I would like to claim for the left because it's the nation's most effective and widespread anarchist organization that has almost no budget and yet has influenced millions of lives, involves people meeting total strangers in the parts of their lives when they're the most vulnerable and unstable. For many, even though there's debates over the science of it or the kind of non-secularism of it, changes many of their lives. And if it doesn't do that, at least builds community in a deep way and says that you don't need to turn to large centralized bureaucracies and expertise to help you, but each other, which I think is one of the idea of that, like small communities getting together, seeing each other as humans and helping each other up outside of the market, outside of the state, I think is a very beautiful thing. And Bill W. did that.
Wow, that's a really good one.
I thought when you said Bill W., I thought you were going to say Bill Watterson, the author of Calvin and Hobbes, but this is better.
both. We'll claim both for the left.
Yay.
So that's it for today. Thank you all for tuning in to Current Affairs today. Let's do a sound off to say goodbye. Vanessa A.B.
Thanks for having me.
Brianna Renix.
Thanks.
Sparky Abraham.
Okay, bye.
Nathan J. Robinson.
Thank you and goodbye.
I'm Pete Davis. See you next time. Thank you for listening. Let's do footnotes. BuzzFeed recently called Sweden the most alt-right nation. In May of last year, Richard Spencer himself partnered with two Swedish outfits to create what they called, quote, a more ideological Breitbart, if you can imagine that. Conservative nonfiction does indeed fill the bestsellers list. Bill O'Reilly, for example, is in fact America's best-selling historian. In researching this fact, I discovered, appropriately for this episode, that various right-wing groups have accused the New York Times bestsellers list of having a liberal bias. Glenn Greenwald may be prosecutorial, but according to an analysis of photos he has posted on social media, he owns at least 8 dogs. Flat Earth is a relatively fringe belief, but not as fringe as we discussed. In a survey of over 8,000 Americans, YouGov found that 84% of people have always believed that the Earth is round, 2% firmly believe that the Earth is flat, and 5% used to be sure that the Earth was round, but have now begun to have doubts. We were a bit off about how popular creationism was. Only 38% of Americans hold creationist views of human origins. 57% of Americans believe in at least some form of evolution. Unlike deontologists who emphasize duties and consequentialists who emphasize consequences, virtue ethicists emphasize the role of the virtues, like courage, friendliness, and temperance, in morality. Since the financial crisis, the Blackstone Group has gone on the largest home buying spree in U.S. history, spending $10 billion and purchasing 50,000 homes. As a teenager at Harvard, Jared Kushner spent $8.3 million to buy 40 apartments in Somerville, Massachusetts. Over his 4 years as landlord, his properties amassed 25 housing complaints, including complaints about overflowing dumpsters, pests, sewage odors, heating problems, and, quote, nonsensical financial dealings, unquote, according to the Boston Globe. The Rent Is Too Damn High party was founded in 2005 by two-time New York City mayoral candidate Jimmy McMillan. The party has 3 registered members. Thomas Jefferson is as bad as we said he was. When his neighbor was pondering emancipating his enslaved workers, Jefferson discouraged him from doing so, saying that free blacks were, quote, pests. He wrote that black Americans, quote, griefs are transient, and that their love lacked, quote, a tender, delicate mixture of sentiment and sensation. He was disappointed that the Missouri Compromise limited the Western expansion of slavery, and he loved to punish his own enslaved workers by selling them away from their family and friends. The nickel deserves better. The Bill W. that founded Alcoholics Anonymous is Bill Wilson, not Bill Watterson, the creator of Calvin and Hobbes. As for whether Watterson can be claimed for the left, I did find a 1994 strip in which Calvin's dad pondered whether advertisements are trying to make us discontented with everything we do and insecure about who we are, to which Calvin's mom pondered whether the economy would collapse if people thought about real issues and needs instead of manufactured desires. We think that's enough evidence. Leave us a voicemail at 504-867-8851. All voicemails may be played on the air. If you would like to support us, become a patron on our Patreon page. It's going to be patrons like you who keep this going. If you like Current Affairs, the podcast, you'll love Current Affairs, the magazine. Subscribe and start receiving our beautiful print edition in your mailbox. You've been listening to our theme song, The Gherkin Train, by Joe Smith and the Spicy Pickles. This has been Current Affairs.